1980 that I made my only visit to the Canton Trade Fair, which, of course, by 1980 had much changed its character, because with the Peking being and Shanghai being more and more open to possibilities of doing business for foreigners, the trade fair was no longer the important staging place it had been. But at least it gave me a flavor, and my purpose also in going was to visit the proposed consulate site that the Chinese had offered, which they subsequently withdrew on the claim that the tenants, the radio broadcasting place, could not find other suitable accommodations and would not vacate the premises. And Forestry Minister Luo went to the United States at this point. He had been invited, I think, by the Mississippi delegation, by Mississippi Governor Finch. Although I think Weyerhaeuser, the timber people, also had a hand in that visit. And Chas Freeman gave us a visit at this juncture.
Then, and what was he there for? Just a tour of?
Yes, he was making a tour of. He was with us, I think, for 3 days.
Were you keeping up with political developments in the U.S. at a distance?
Yes, to the extent I could.
We'll get more on that when you come home.
Right. And then on April 28th, we dedicated the Shanghai consulate. That consulate building and grounds, of course, is in terms of China, first class.
How say?
And
Don Anderson says that he feared you were going to seek to come to Shanghai.
There were many jokes about the fact that I should have my residence in Shanghai and keep the embassy in Peking.
What a magnificent lawn in the back.
One of the several visits of Frank Gibney.
But let's not move off that subject for a minute.
Okay.
Let's talk about the opening of consulates and what it meant for the embassy. How did you relate to Don Anderson in Shanghai and Dick Williams down in Guangzhou?
In Guangzhou, of course, my visits there were more frequent because at this point it was still impossible to go directly to Hong Kong without stopping in Guangzhou. Visits to Shanghai would have to be for a given purpose or especially to visit the consulate so that didn't get there as frequently as we should. But Don Anderson and Dick Williams would come frequently to Peking and come at the same time so that along with the consular officer in Peking, they could talk about common problems in the consular service and would bring with them as needed the particular officers in the consulate. The same thing was true of the administration officers in Shanghai and Guangzhou, who would keep in close touch with the administrative section in Peking.
They did not have, did they have secure communication channels with Peking?
Not at that point, no.
So that they could not, for example, really do interesting political reporting and send it back to you? Except by pouch, I guess.
Right. Or, in the case of Guangzhou, taking it over to Hong Kong and having it sent from there. But that was obtained later. First in Guangzhou, as I remember it, and then in Shanghai. But no, there was no secure telephonic communication.
Well, there was no secure telephonic communication between Peking and Washington.
That's correct.
We tried for that, didn't we? And
yes.
Did not succeed.
We made two or three attempts at it, and but again, a catch-22 situation. Would we reciprocate? And although there was no possibility of it being done at that point for the Chinese, my answer had to be no. We will not reciprocate.
Why not? I wonder.
I never could make sense of it. I argued, but to no avail.
That's really a reflection of bureaucratic politics in
right.
Washington. lets you know what agency has a lot of clout. How were cables from Anderson and Williams? They came. This all came on fully after I left, so I don't understand this part of the operation. But how did they send cables back to Washington? Did you have to clear on a consular cable?
Would depend on the nature of the communication. Because I know on one occasion we had an argument with Dick Williams. He had sent something indirectly, which was in the area that had to. It was more than just a consular matter. It was an embassy matter, and he had done it purely by forgetfulness.
Sure. What is the delineation? What was the boundary? I don't understand. This aspect of State Department, I just know nothing about.
Well, if they have observations to make affecting the political relationship of the governments and so on, that has to come through the embassy, so that they have their full right of saying what they wish, and it is forwarded. But the embassy has to have the right to comment on it. It doesn't necessarily operate on a veto, on a censorship basis, but getting its input. If it is simply things having to do with consular matters, then that was done directly. This, by virtue of the embassy saying it is okay for you to send these things directly, and the embassy could have also said that these matters too had to come through Peking.
Mm-hmm. And then, did you personally monitor the cable traffic, or did you have someone in your embassy who was, in effect, responsible for the consulate down in Canton?
Well, the incoming traffic where it involved political or other matters would, as I remember, go directly to the deputy and then come to me.
Mm-hmm.
If it was on consular matters, it would go directly to the consular section.
Consular matters being visas.
Right.
district.
And policy problems that that could develop, but on such matters, the deputy would also get involved if it, particularly if it required anything to be done with the Chinese. Was aware of it.
Okay, well, let's take as one example this Mosier case. Researcher who was in a village in Canton. Now, did you all get involved in that?
Yes, it was handled.
How would that work?
My memory of that is the minute it happened and Dick Williams was aware of it, he immediately notified us as to the problems involved. And he, I think, had some conversations with Chinese officials in Guangzhou. But John Thompson took it up either with whatever ministry was involved.
Mm-hmm. This is when he was caught at customs with gold coins, and that's when he went off in the van to Guizhou province. Remember, he was two things.
Right. This was pretty late in 1980, wasn't it?
I don't remember when it happened. I only learned about it when I visited China in early 1981, but I thought it had happened some months before.
It had, right.
So that it was... I do not think it had just happened in, let's say, in the late fall of October to December 80. I think it was earlier than that, but I literally don't remember.
My memory puts it somewhere in the fall of, mm-hmm. of 80. Later than this time, certainly.
Right.
It was later because I had been myself involved in... discussions with the Ministry of Education, along with John Thompson, about access in Nanjing in particular.
Oh, that's right. You really went to bat for access to American scholars.
Well, the reason that we chose Nanjing to make an issue of and to have me involved as ambassador was because in the beginning Nanjing had quite a liberal policy. And suddenly they tightened up so that it was not possible to have the defense to say, well, those the records are in such a mess that they can't be used and so on, because they had been used by Americans. And we got a sympathetic audience at the higher levels. But it wasn't always followed through on. We wouldn't get a flat commitment in our discussions in Peking. This, and this mm-hmm. will happen, because mm-hmm. it doesn't work that way. But certainly we left with the belief that things would be different. And ultimately they were, but there was a lot of foot dragging locally.
Now, on this Nanking, again, you had a consulate in Shanghai. Because we're trying to address the subject of the relations between the embassy and a consulate, when you went in to talk about a situation in Nanking, did you consult with the Shanghai people? Did they go in simultaneously since Nanking was in the Shanghai district? How did that work?
Not at this point, we didn't have our consular agreement worked out. And so the district for Shanghai and Guangzhou had not been agreed. And it now comes back to me. My involvement in Nanking was because one of the American scholars, a woman, had written directly to me telling of her earlier experiences where she had access and suddenly had, oh, I know what had happened. She had visited Peking at an earlier time and had told me of the very favorable circumstances that had developed in Nanking and how much better off the few Americans who were there were in this particular than in other locations where we were having continuing difficulties. And then some months later, after telling me this, she then wrote me a letter to say, well, this picture had changed. That's how I got involved, because that was purely Peking. Now, had Shanghai had its then had its district as it was ultimately determined, they would certainly have pursued it at the local level to try and solve the problem, and only if that proved to be not yielding of results would we take it up in Peking, because in general, the experience was that top-level involvement did not necessarily bring relief and could,
right,
in effect, harden attitudes. And our general posture was to do everything possible to work things out locally, figuring that if we tried in many different places, there was more possibility of success than centralizing it and reaching a hard situation.
So that having the consulates really then become could become from your perspective, quite important in facilitating American business, American research in China, the consulate general becomes as active and sophisticated in his local community as you had been in Peking.
Yes, and of course that particularly was the way Shanghai was developing, because the local officials with which they were dealing were also quite sophisticated, and I would expect that they'd make quite a bit of progress in that kind of thing in that area.
That's interesting. And would you say the same for Canton?
Sophistication in commercial matters, yes, not necessarily in cultural and scholarly matters.
Less Western, anyway, I would guess. Canton had a Western exposure, but it was not quite as extensive as the Shanghai exposure before 49.
No, not as intellectual.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Interesting.
It'll be interesting to see. Watch the developments when Shenyang and Chengdu and Wuhan are ultimately open. I would think in Chengdu, for example, that you'd find a fairly favorable atmosphere because of the way things have developed. But the consulates can be of great assistance now. I understand the last regulation indicates that people are not going to be allowed out in the field for more than 2 or 3 weeks at a time.
You mean on research?
Right.
Well, it's, as we've just been talking, there's such a discrepancy between the regulations in the center and what can one do, what one can do in the locality if one has the arrangements. Ohio State has been having people do research in the field in Hubei province because of the provincial exchanges and for extensive periods of time. I've just got a letter from Jiaotung University that welcomes Eileen Blumenthal to do field research in a whole series of middle schools. I think it's a very mixed picture, and I would not be too put off by these standard regulations. But Americans have to behave themselves. We've we've had now some unfortunate cases. The Mosier case was, in my view, a very serious violation of Chinese confidence in field research. It was the most unfortunate precedent. And then in 1982, this girl who was kicked out, also somewhat unfortunate. Chinese did not handle that one well, but the American researchers, I think, from their arrival in China, have been maybe a little bit overly aggressive. They've exhibited an attitude that this is their one great opportunity to make a career, rather than looking at it as the first time in China, hopefully of many times, where you begin to have to work in a Chinese way. You know, Americans don't deserve classified material from the first day they enter the country.
No, true. Mr. Sun, by the way, was of the opinion that the incident involving the woman, recent incident, was in retaliation for the Michigan Papers episode.
I have the same feeling.
It wasn't knowledge, it was a feeling that, not just himself, he said, that his colleagues here. Vice Premier Zhao Zhujiang. Who is that?
Vice Premier, now Premier.
Oh, that's what it's supposed to be.
That you had a session with?
Yeah, I'd knowing that I was going to go to the U.S. very shortly in connection with the Gongbiao visit. And Zhao Zhujiang, I couldn't read the writing, had just been named responsible vice premier. And I'd asked Han Xu, would it be possible to have a meeting with him before I went to the U.S.? And within two days, I got the appointment. First time I met him, and I was very much impressed. We met in the Great Hall of the People, and he talked about the economic problems. He said, "Our prices do not reflect true value."
Was this a meeting that was on the record, by the way, or was this a private audience?
This was just the two of us.
Fascinating.
Because he said our prices do not reflect true value, and of course it is difficult to bring them to the point. We have to take time to have them reflect true value. And he's going on at considerable length talking about not only the economic problems, but the solutions to those problems, and suddenly he stops. He says, but I am telling you things that I have not told my own people. He said, are you going to be telling this to the American press? And I said, all the American press will know, Mr. Vice Premier, is that we had a meeting. I will not discuss with them what we talked about. So then he continued. I asked him, what did it mean that he was the responsible vice premier? Was he, in effect, in charge of the work of the others? Was he a chairman of the group? He said he was in charge of day-to-day activities. He did not make policy, he said. Policy was made by Deng Xiaoping, and he also instanced Hua Guofeng. And his references to Hua Guofeng at this juncture, and this was quite interesting, was very respectful, which would indicate a caution on his part. And certainly to a to a foreigner, he was not going to say anything more than that. But it was a very rewarding session, and really impressed me as one who had a good grasp of the economic situation in China, a vision of what he wanted to have done through the government to help correct these things, and I was Mr. G attended that, not as the interpreter, but I'd asked not only Han Shu and Ji Zhaoju were together when I made the request, and Mr. G attended the session. And it was a very rewarding session.
Who on the American side was present? Did State go?
No, Stape didn't go. My note here doesn't indicate. I think I was alone.
So you didn't have a note taker?
I think I was alone.
Did you send back a long report table on this one?
I don't think so. I think it was understood. That was the ground rule that was laid down for the meeting.
Fascinating, because I had not heard of this meeting before.
That was the ground rule laid down for the meeting.
I don't think it got into the press then in the end.
I was never even asked by the press. They were unaware.
Was this your only meeting with Zhao?
I saw him. I asked to see him before I left, and he received me then.
How long did this meeting last?
Oh, darn, 10, 15 minutes.
And was the subject exclusively limited to his presentation of the Chinese domestic scene?
Yes. There was no discussion of foreign policy. Yes, it was entirely on domestic matters.
Was there any foreshadowing of the retrenchment that came on in late December?
No. It was more geared to the economic reforms with which he'd been identified in the Sichuan province. And quite a lot of discussion about agriculture. And the reforms which by this time were moving along fairly well in the agricultural field.
I suspect that the Chinese took notes, and that must be, as they frequently do, those notes are distributed within the bureaucracy, so that one of the things he was doing was going on record for his own higher level cadres, his views.
I would think so, yes. Yeah, they of course made notes.
Did he talk then about what, agriculture reforms, price, industrial reform?
Yes.
That was the Sichuan side of things.
Right.
Government deficit problems come up?
No. First time I heard of that was when I attended the National People's Congress meetings in September of 80.
Military modernization?
I think in regard to the need to develop the industrial infrastructure before that could be successfully challenged.
I don't wish to read something into it, but what, in other words, as you reflect back, what was his message? What was he trying to do in this particular meeting? What was Ji Chao Ju's briefing paper for? Put another way.
Well, looking back, what he put forward was novel in a national sense, but it was not novel in the sense of what he had done, of which we were not too aware at that, this point in Sichuan province. I think, too, from his point of view, I was going back to the United States, and I think he wanted to make as favorable an impression as possible, on the assumption that I would be going back to Washington,
right,
to say our opinion of him as a personage and so on, because at this point there are still high hopes for the speedy development of our relationship. The preparations for the Gung Biao visit were part and parcel of those high hopes.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at, though, is did he do anything to feed hopes about the development of a security and military relationship?
No. Not in that sense, no.
I don't want to press the point, but I have had a suspicion, but nothing more than that, that the Zhao was not one to be too eager to develop a military relationship, particularly if it were to include purchase of either military technology or weapons abroad, that he had such a heavy emphasis on China's need to develop its industrial infrastructure, increase its agricultural production, that he assigned a very low priority to the military realm. Let me just go one step further to say, maybe one way of interpreting what he said, but I raise this as a hypothesis, is to say, Gung is going to the U.S., but what I'm not going to tell you in this presentation is that I have attached in my overall program high priority to what he's doing. My priorities are A, B, and C, and I'm not going to talk about D.
Would have been possible to make that interpretation.
I admit it, with the advantage of hindsight,
right,
you could see that.
But at the time, I was most impressed with his quite frank discussion of the economic problems and the solutions as he saw them. There was no reference to inflation as such, as there was in not too long after that, and quite an optimistic assessment as to the positive value of the reforms, which more optimistic than at least to date has proven to be the case, with the exception of agriculture, I accept agriculture. But although I'd asked for the meeting knowing I was going to the United States, Kung Biao, visit was a primary part of that. I was not struck at the time by the
right.
fact that he did not talk about military matters.
And did he begin the meeting with the perfunctory statements about the Sino-American relationship, or did he just immediately go to the economic?
I think it began by my thanking him for the meeting, that I had very much wanted to see him before I went to the United States, and that I was intrigued by his designation as the responsible vice premier, and my government would of course be most interested in knowing what that meant in an operational sense. Describing he was responsible for day-to-day activities. He did not, as an individual, make policy, and then the references to Deng Xiaoping and Hua Guofeng. He then began the description of economic problems. Went from there. In that same meeting with Han Xu and Ji Zhaoju, I had also put forward that at some point I would like to, when I got back from the United States, if possible, have a meeting with Hu Yaobang. But I think I've mentioned before that was sort of frowned upon because he was not a government person, he was a party person. I didn't back off for that reason, but I never pursued it, and I regret very much that I didn't pursue it, because it was indicated that could be arranged, but I never raised the matter again. Then, at this point, we left for the United States. We went directly to New York from Tokyo. The reason we're going to New York is that I was to get an honorary degree from Columbia University. And I also spoke at the annual alumni luncheon on
at Columbia?
Yes, in connection with the commencement exercises. And I made an appearance.
Was it about China? What was
about China? Yes.
What was your message at that time? Do you remember?
It was pretty much upbeat. Upbeat in the sense that the initial expectations had been very much overblown, but there were still possibilities, chances, and that the relationship was had moved at almost an incredible speed. Still much work to be done, but I was hopeful of the future, that sort of thing. Then while I was in New York, Gil Robinson had me come to a luncheon to which a group of American businessmen had been invited to looking back, I think my purpose there was to give them some reassurance as to the exhibition, because there were financing problems. Morgan Guaranty Bank people were there, I know. I think they'd already begun to have difficulties with Crocker National. I think they had withdrawn from the supporting financial cast. I didn't say very much. It was whatever comfort was to be drawn was from the very fact I was there, I guess. And also visited the Chinese bronze exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum. We had seen the exhibit. It wasn't really an exhibit in China before it was packed, but they'd put it in showcases. And then to see it in Peking in those rather primitive circumstances, and then see the marvelous way in which the exhibit was housed at the Metropolitan. It truly was a fascinating show. Together with, of course, the six terracotta figures that they had from Xi'an, the four horses and the two warriors. Then I went to Washington and had an informal get together with House Foreign Affairs Committee. Chairman Zablocki was there and others. There were inquiries about China. It was very positive. Then the next day with
the military business come up?
The upcoming visit came up, yes.
Was Lester Wolfe there?
No, I met the next day. Mm-hmm. I met with Lester Wolfe and his staff. And on that same day with an informal session with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Then went out to Langley, met with Stanfield Turner and Frank Carlucci, John Holdridge, and Bill Grave, who had responsibility for East Asia.
Right.
And met for the first time Jack Downing, who was scheduled to
come out.
And Jack had been the personal assistant to Admiral Turner, and of course had been chosen because of Chestnut, I think. He certainly was an excellent choice and was a great station chief. And then I see at 11:15 I met with seven of the people involved in the Chestnut operation. At the time of the Shanghai consulate dedication was the day that I learned of Cy Vance's resignation over the abortive. He didn't resign because of the abortive attempt. He was opposed to the attempt, and I felt very keenly about that. Always had considerable affection for Secretary Vance. And time, of course, we get, I get to Washington, at Muskie has been